I'll call the commission to order. We will begin with the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance.
I'd like to start item C with our land acknowledgement. The Alameda County Parks, Recreation and Historical Commission recognizes and appreciates the indigenous people who lived in this area for thousands of years in relative harmony. Good item D, roll call.
Commissioner Farley?
Here.
Commissioner Felix? Not yet present. Commissioner Thomas? Also not yet present. Commissioner Menard?
Present.
Commissioner Willis? And Chair Patterson?
I'm here.
We have a quorum.
And next we'll do the open forum, and that's to any member of the audience that would like to speak on an issue not otherwise indicated on this agenda for today.
We have no speakers.
Move on to item F, approval of the minutes. I hear a doorbell.
Still have no speakers for clarification.
Okay, very well. Then we'll move on to approval of minutes for the September 4th meeting. And does anyone have any issues regarding these draft minutes from the September 4th meeting?
Have none.
Move that we accept as presented.
Second.
Motion. It's been seconded. Let's play up the vote.
Commissioner Farley?
Aye.
Commissioner Menard?
Yes.
Commissioner Willis?
Aye.
Commissioner Patterson?
Aye.
Motion passes.
Move on to chair and staff reports. I was to meet with Mr. DeVinny as chair, but he was relatively engaged last week, and he said he would reach out to me this week. He has not done so yet, so I'm waiting to hear from him. I should just stop and ask if there's anyone in the audience that has any issues regarding our minutes or any previous items, A through F. Anything?
No raised hands.
Okay. Staff report?
This time, staff has none.
Okay, we'll go on to new business. There is a change to the agenda on item H. We will consider the proposed demolition of the existing bungalow building with monitor on property located at 1797 D Street first. Then we will move to the second item, which will be the Ralph M. Brown Act and Code of Conduct training. And we will continue with item three, appoint the Parks and Recreation and Historical Commission members to participate a nominating committee for switch items one and two. So let us begin with now item one, which is to consider the proposed demolition of the building at 1797 D Street. I want to thank staff for the report, the dated report. And does anyone have any concerns from the commission?
But I think we have.
Seeing those speak.
Staff has no raised hands.
audience, but no cards.
And just for clarification, this is Rodrigo doing it with the County Planning Department. Staff did have a presentation to summarize the request from last time and to give responses this time. They're also in your staff report, and members of the Hayward Area Recreation and Park District are here to speak in more detail on those answers if the commission wishes.
Then let's hear it.
This is Amy Claros with the Planning Department, presenting on PLN 2025-0032, which is the historical assessment for proposed demolition of a bungalow building with a monitor and other structures on the property. The property owners are Hard and the applicants, located at 1797 D Street in Fairview.
Not picking up very good. It sounded mumblish.
Right. So this is located in Fairview. There we go. Northwest and south is the city of Hayward, and east is Fairview. It's the first parcel on D Street in Fairview. Previous PRHC hearings on April 3rd, 2025, the PRHC voted to continue this item to give Hard time to submit a historical resources evaluation report by an architectural historian. And at the previous meeting, August 7th, 2025, PRHC voted unanimously to continue this item to confirm if there are any relation to the Sorensen family and Martin Sorensen, who was the first recorded owner, and requested a survey done within 1/2 mile radius of the property to determine if there's any minor sale buildings. So the first request was the Sorensen Bros Mortuary. The Sorensen Bros Mortuary was the oldest family operated and owned business in Hayward, and the business was acquired by the Diocese of Oakland Catholic Cemeteries and now operates the Sorensen Chapel in Hayward. And Sorensen Brothers had no relation to 1797 D Street. They did not live there or operate the business there. And it's unlikely that they were related to Martin Sorensen, who was the constructor of the primary residence. And the primary residence at 1797 D Street is not a true monitor. A true monitor would be a skylight that emits light and air to the building. And 1797 D Street is a second story addition. It has a bedroom. And the second story addition was built sometime between 1916 and 1931. And in Greater Alameda County, there's numerous craftsman bungalows with monitors and second stories in Cherryland, Ashland, Hayward, and Oakland. So 1797 D Street is not representative of Fairview's rural nature or Alameda County, as it lacks notable craftsman features and is in poor condition. Staff recommends that the commission make a determination that the structure is not a historical resource or structure of merit and recommend demolition of all structures on the property to the planning director to expand Sulphur Creek Nature Center.
And again, Hart is here to speak further in detail on the condition of the building. So if the chair wishes, they would like to continue.
Yes.
Good afternoon again. My name is Megan Tiernan. I'm the Capital Planning and Development Director for Hayward Area Recreation District. We've been here two times before to just remind you, we bought this 1.4 acre property, which is directly adjacent to the Sulphur Creek Nature Center, with the intention of expanding the Nature Center property. We had done a home inspection of the house, and it was determined to be in very, very poor condition. So we submitted for a demo permit. This commission asked us to prepare an architectural resources report, and I have our consultant with us today, Christopher Plank, who will come up after me, and he can explain a little bit more about the two questions you was asked about the Sorensen Brothers connection and the monitor in a little bit more detail. So I'll introduce Christopher Plank right now.
Thanks, Commissioner. My name is Christopher Plank. I'm a San Francisco-based architectural historian. And this was a really interesting project to research. Really got into the weeds, literally and figuratively, of how this property came to be. In regard to your questions, I did additional research in regard to the Sorensen potential connection. I learned in the course of my research that Sorensen is the ninth most popular name, common name in Denmark. I'm sure that Martin Sorensen knew Lawrence and Henry Sorensen. They both grew up in the same area, Mount Eden Township. They were both Danish. They belonged to the Danio Society Lodge Number 9. I'm sure they knew each other. I couldn't find any relationship between them. Their families came from different regions of Denmark, and they don't seem to have socialized. Back in the day, the newspapers reported almost every social event that took place in Fairview, and it seems that the Sorensen brothers were never invited to Martin's house. So, yeah, I couldn't see any firm connection. In regard to the second question, in regard to the monitor type bungalow, I did do a survey using Google Maps and Google Street View within a mile and a half radius of 1797 D Street. A mile and a half radius took in mostly incorporated Hayward, so I could look at those areas. Took in most of Fairview, and it took in a good chunk of Castro Valley, including the Baywood neighborhood. And what I found was that most of this area was developed after World War II, so it's mainly ranchers and minimal that really are analogous to 1797 D Street. There are some bungalows, but none of them have this type of roof. And as Amy mentioned, monitor is an architectural term that refers to basically a three-dimensional skylight that kind of sits on top of the building. And this is actually a true second story. I didn't find any like that in Fairview, but I did take the liberty of drawing a larger radius, 2 miles, which got me into Cherryland. And Cherryland was developed earlier and has lots of craftsman bungalows. And I included about five that I found that had similar second story additions. So my conclusion was that even if Fairview doesn't have any that are quite like this, there are other unincorporated communities in and around Hayward that do have them.
Interrupt. My name is Linda Willis. Just a quick question. I was a little confused about the monitor. Apparently it's for, originally was for agriculture to look inside of a structure. And you're saying it's only was a second story addition. So does that mean it wasn't related to the agriculture? It was just a second story like a normal house or?
Exactly. And the way it's, I mean, I have to give Martin Sorensen credit because he did a nice job. I mean, it sort of matches the rest of the house. It's not very clunky. The ornament's the same, but it was an addition. When I climbed up into the attic, I could see the saw cut marks in the rafters. So I could see that they were actually physically cut to build this. Don't know when, there's no permits, but I did find a historic photograph taken about 1930 when the reservoir next door is being built. And you can see that the second story addition is in place at that time. So it probably happened pretty early. I don't know why they built it. I suspect they wanted a better view because the view from that room is you have a nice view over Castro Valley and, Chabot, Lake Chabot and all that kind of stuff. The term monitor, you typically find those on industrial buildings, factories, and some agricultural buildings that need air and ventilation, like a chicken coop, like a chicken house will have one so the fumes go out. But they're open to the floor within. That's not the case with this addition. There's a stair that goes up to it, and it's got a full floor.
But it's technically not considered a true monitor. Is that correct? Okay.
James, is there anything of historical value in the house, that hardware maybe, or anything that can be preserved that is worth saving, like pieces that we might want to take out of there before they demolish the building?
That's a good question. I always look at that because I love old things, and my house is a 1931 time capsule, and I'm always looking for things like that. The interior of the house has been pretty extensively remodeled. The only room that really has any original finishes is the living room, which has unpainted paneling. Whether that could be removed or not without breaking it, I don't know. It had one built-in cabinet, and there was like a kind of built-in seating area. Those are the only things that I saw inside that could
be. I see a lot of the old houses, they have like the hardware on the doors and stuff like that that's worth saving, So that's why I brought it up, just to.
Yeah, the front door, possibly. The front door looks original, and there is original hardware on it. But there is really not much else inside.
Yeah, and I'm the one that asked the question about the Sorensens, because it had a criteria on there that wasn't met in my eye, because It said if there was any famous people or any famous businesses, that's why I wanted it. And I thank you for following through on that.
Linda again. So there's a sideboard, looks like, in the living room. But I was also curious, a lot of the houses in the, of that time were made of hand-cut redwood. Is the exterior of the building redwood, or is it hand-cut wood? Or
it would be industrially produced by this point. It, whether it's made of redwood or not, I'm not sure. It probably is.
It was 1916.
Yeah. But at that point, it would have been industrially produced, you know, milled and so it wouldn't be hand hewn or anything like that. And I didn't see any, there was no exposed framing inside. Well, there was in the attic, and that was a combination of redwood and probably Douglas fir.
I have a question. This is Al. Mentioned that there's no permits required, no permits that were done on this house on the addition of the second story. I'm going to call it that. That was pretty common, wasn't it? And that the county didn't have anybody in the planning commission that was monitoring that kind of stuff. So it was pretty much just done on your own.
That's completely correct. That's my experience with most counties in the Bay Area. Unincorporated areas typically don't really start to keep permits. They may have required it, but they didn't really keep them. They just throw them away as soon as, you know, the building was done. Until the 50s and 60s, it seems, is
when okay.
They start to Kurtz.
And traditionally, historical commissions do not consider condition of the houses a value as an item that needs to be put into the pot for consideration, because if it's a historic building, it needs to be preserved. And my only concern is that it's everything I've read on it seems to say that it's a gateway building into Fairview. And gateway buildings are critical for most historical preservation, in that if you lose a gateway building, then the next building down, all of them start disappearing because of new development moving in. And that's a concern on gateway buildings particularly. And you haven't really addressed that kind of.
It's a good question. In regard to the gateway issue, what I did notice when I first went to the site and I drove up to the site was that it was pretty well blocked by the eucalyptus trees that surround the reservoir. I couldn't see the building until I was right in front of it coming up D Street. To say it's not the first building in Fairview, it is. But it doesn't really stand out until you're right in front of it. What was my opinion when I went to the site. There is a row of earlier crafts and bungalows just beyond it. It's pretty much the oldest row in Fairview, it seems. There's probably about four or five houses that are about similar vintage along that block, I would say.
And even though in original historical analysis, they mentioned it, we did not. They called it a monitor. And so that's what we've been going with, was a monitor, because that's what we got from whoever reviewed it the first time around. And I asked about other second story or monitors in the area, and you've pretty much answered that. And it seems as though traditionally that most of the time, second story monitors that are built in a historical neighborhood by the original owner and stuff like that has historical relevance. And those things tend to be preserved as much as you can, even though it's not a monitor, it's a second story, but it was done so long ago that it generates a historical value.
Building eligible for the California Register or some other register, changes that the original owner made in the house would be character defining. Since I concluded that the building was not eligible at the beginning, it wouldn't necessarily add any value to it that it was built by the original owner. Make sense?
Sort of, but you showed in your report, you showed pictures of other houses, their craftsman style houses, I believe in Berkeley, and then had the same porch and the roof structure, except they didn't have the monitor, the second story on it. And they look very similar, except for the second monitor, the second story. And it seems like they're very similar.
Right. I mean, if you took the monitor off this house, you could put it down in any number of neighborhoods in Hayward, in Oakland, even Francisco. That's what these some bungalows, very common building type, you know, from the teens. No mistaking that it's a Crescent bungalow.
Did you say your title was again? You were a historical...
architectural historian and historic preservation consultant. So I do consultation on restoration, and I do, you know, these historical resource evaluations mainly.
You certified?
There is no certification process. I mean, I hold a master's degree in architectural history and preservation, but there's no certifying board for my profession.
So, I have a couple of questions, but do you have more that you want to present before I ask the questions?
No, go ahead. I just finished when you asked.
You the did. Question. Okay, yeah. Great. Well, first of all, I want to say this is incredibly thorough and very helpful. I think even for our commission, a lot of the places that you named would be really helpful for us in surveying historical buildings. So I really appreciate the work that you've done. My questions kind of concern the structure of merit on page, let's see. Well, first of all, let's go to page 28. So you were listing the first grantor as the Sorensons, but if you look back, it says that the first person, 1872, was Faxton Dean Atherton. And believe that that person was a historic figure, at least from the past. Did you?
Yes. Yeah, he was one of the big Peter Hayward. But a lot of, you know, the original. You know, over time, he sold out. He didn't live here. He lived in Atherton. Okay. And he subdivided the land holdings that he acquired into smaller parcels, mainly sold them off as ranches, smaller ranches, and smaller parcels. But he never lived on the property. In order to be significant in association with a person, Atherton would have had to have had some connection with that specific he lived. There's evidence that he did.
And the general characteristics, so criterion 5, it says that this is on page 32, and it says that the D Street does not qualify as a structure of merit under criterion 5, although subject property may embody the general characteristics of a pre-war rural property in Fairview, it is far from the best example. And I'm just not clear if a building that is historic, which it is by age alone, and it is craftsman, but it's necessary for it to be a best example, there to be considered. Designation there.
I mean, certainly for the California Register, that's the case. I guess, you know, the point I was trying to make is that you could take this house and drop it down in an urban scenario, and it would look out of place in a lot of Oakland or, you know, older parts of Hayward. It didn't really embody that sort of typical sort of like folk Victorian vocabulary you'd expect to find in a farming area where there were ranches. So to me, it didn't really look like a rural building, much as it did kind of a standard issue urban bungalow that Martin Sorensen happened to build in this location. if it makes sense.
It does somewhat, but basically, I think that the basics of its historic nature is that it's a craftsman bungalow, correct?
Under the county criteria?
Right.
I mean, it is a craftsman bungalow. Yeah. I mean, it's, but I would argue that it's a very basic one. You know, it, some of the notes, I mean, it has the knee braces, it has the exposed struts, it has the porch, with the battered piers. The windows have been replaced. The interior is completely gone except for the living room. It just didn't jump out to me as being a really good example I love the craftsman style personally. I live in a craftsman, but yeah, it just didn't rise to the level of a really significant craftsman dwelling, in my opinion.
And there was also some mention of the house had been removed, part of the reason.
That was, you know, my sense of rural California, and in the Bay Area in particular, these tank houses were oftentimes associated with these types of small and even bigger ranches,
right?
You know, because you needed to have water source somehow. And I suspect, although I don't know, when they built the reservoir next door, the city of Hayward built that. The city bought that land from Sorensen. I suspect they probably tapped him into the water, because the tank house disappeared not long after that.
But even if it didn't have a tank house, it's still a craftsman bungalow of over 50 years of age. So, you know, since my dilemma in this whole thing is it is historic by its age and by its design. The best example of a swim bungalow in but as a commission, you know, we're very concerned about the loss of historic buildings, which happen pretty regularly. So you know, that's why we've asked for this report, which you've done a really good job on. But still, it's sort of like your opinion that it's not quite, it's historic, but not quite enough, because it's not a stellar example of this type of historic property.
Yeah, I mean, with architectural significance, there are various aspects to it. For one thing, is it a good example? Is it a very good example of a style? Was it designed by a significant architect? Was it built by a notable builder? Is it a rare example? Is it the best example? I mean, there are various sort of sub-criteria within that criterion. And when I looked at them all, you know, I tried to balance them, and there's no subcategory where it sort of jumped to the fore and said to me, this is a really important building. It's cute. You know, it speaks of a time and place, but to me, it didn't hit the mark.
I think probably the mark for the Alameda County Register is certainly a little bit. You're talking about subcategories that you just spoke about. So yes, it probably would not qualify for the California Register under the criteria you've just discussed. But I think under our criteria, it probably could qualify. So my dilemma in this discussion is, it is somewhat historic, and but not the best example of history. I understand the economic issues for Hard, that this is a building that they own that they can't use, that they want to make way into Sulphur Creek, which is a very cherished park in this area. So I don't know. That's just how I leave it. One other question I had, the other speakers suggested that it was in really poor condition. I think that was mentioned several at the last meeting. Is that the inside's in poor condition or the outside's in poor condition? The outside looks okay to me, but historian. So
I didn't do a conditions analysis because they'd already, HART had already had already commissioned one. I did review it. And I did notice as I was walking around, and I mean, I'm not an engineer, so I'm not really able to say, you know, but I do have a lot of experience with older buildings, and I can tell when buildings are sound or not sound. And one thing I did notice was that the floors are very squishy, which is never a good sign. Because oftentimes,
saying the boards inside the house or the boards outside?
Basically, the floor joists that support the floor, they kind of gave when you walked on them. And that's always a bad sign, because it typically means termites have undermined the structure of the house. And in order to make it serviceable again, it'd probably have to be, you know, stripped down to the frame. I mean, at least inside the house, and replace everything that is rotted out or termite munched.
But if I'm understanding you correctly, it could be a pretty expensive to.
Because when I first saw it, I was like, oh, if this building was intact, they could move it somewhere, right? But when I walked, in fact, we talked about that. But when I walked through it, I was like, oh, well, it just hasn't been maintained well for probably, I don't know, 50, 60 years at least. That's what it felt like to me.
It's pretty common. This is okay. Well, thank you very much for your answers.
Thank you very much.
I have one more question. One of the things is that to get on the county register, the property owner has to submit their nomination. So the advantage we have on this building is that it's owned by a public agency. So as we are part of the public, we can nominate it. And it, as I understand the rules, it cannot be kept off, even if the owner says, oh, I don't want to put it on the register, because we are the public that puts it on. And because there's so few craftsmen on our historical register, and we don't have any others right now, and nobody is stepping up to nominate their house, their craftsman house, for the county register, and this one's available to us, I don't see why we can't put it on the register. You know, I think it belongs probably on the county register.
I don't know if I can address that point. Maybe I should defer to HART on that one.
And we're here seeking a approval for a demolition permit because we've already looked at the building. It's not suitable for reuse. We have not considered putting it on a register. We've come to this board three times now. We hired an architectural historian, and his report is that it's not historically significant. And so I don't believe that it's that putting it on the county register is something that we're seeking. Thank you.
Are there any other questions? And does the public have any input on this matter?
There are no speakers.
A comment, an observation, really. We have, as a commission, been concerned about the deterioration of historical buildings or properties about unincorporated Alameda County, and to a point where they are so dilapidated or you can't go back. They have to be demolished. And I hear that this commission is in a mode that wants to rescue those buildings before they become dilapidated. And if you look at our minutes, read our minutes through the past year, we've had many a conversation about how to keep those buildings. And apparently D Street is in the crosshairs. We understand what HARD would like to do. I think to Linda's point, the park is a very special place that we would like to see continue. We also see that this D Street building does present a unique historical value of Hayward, of Yore. So those are my comments. I do recognize that the commission wants to keep things around. But with that in mind, if there are any other comments from the commissioners, they will make a motion that we consider the proposal to demolish 1797 D Street.
I have a comment. I'm not sure that as a commission we're expected to weigh in on economic issues regarding a demolition. On the other hand, we're talking about two public entities here, so that will be significantly financed to either keep a building that is in disrepair or to try to repurpose it, which we, you know, hope most historic buildings will do. I just want all of us to think about, yes, it's historic. Is it important to consider how historic it is in terms of this? Its ultimate purpose will be, it's be made in special. I hope that's within our purview to consider historic report in terms of it's historic. It's basically historic, but is it valuable historic? I guess that's my.
I've been on this commission for a little while now, and it's really sad. We do lose a lot of buildings, and I look at other jurisdictions that have money funding sources. They actually fund old buildings, and it's incredible because they don't wait till the last minute when it's destroyed and we lost our another resource. They fix them along as they go along. They actually have a funding source. I did research on this on some other towns, Houston for example, and they had some historical districts that actually fund their old buildings, and we don't in Alameda County, and I'd like to see that change. But I that's why I'm so passionate, and I like to be on this committee because I'm passionate about old buildings. So
go ahead.
I have one more question. I know that Hart is concerned about this building because of its what they considered access to Sulphur Creek. And in Fremont, we've had a lot of historic buildings that have been relocated onto the property so that they're still on the property, but not blocking the access to the park. Is there a possibility that the building could be relocated to another area of the park so that you could repurpose it for offices or something like that and still use the property and have the gateway that you're looking for?
Concern is that the building is in such disrepair that simply moving it somewhere else on the site still leaves us with the same issues.
Again,
just leaves us with the same issues. The building has the wood is rotted. It has termites. The siding is shot. The roof is shot. It's just simply moving it doesn't remove any of those issues for us.
We're trying to preserve this building, and right now, the restoration of the building, no matter how much it costs, is beyond our purview, basically. So what we're concerned about is the preservation of the building in any condition. And If we can get it relocated to another site on the park so you can have your gateway into Sulphur Creek there, which is what you wanted. And you said early on that that was it was obstructing the view of access to Sulphur Creek. Why can't we just move it to another location and restore it and repurpose it?
Understand that your concern is not financial, it's capital planning and development directed hardline is. And so I do have to consider what the cost is to our...
I know you do, but we don't.
Right. You're asking me to answer that question.
Yes.
So please understand that I'm answering it as capital planning and development director. It would be very expensive to try to move that building and then try to rehab it. And as our historian said, so much of it is damaged. Is how much of the original structure would be left after we fixed everything that's broken?
A motion, but I also see that, is there a raised hand from the audience?
That's correct, there is a raised hand.
Okay, so I'm gonna rescind that motion right now because it hasn't been seconded and we're still in that comment stage. And it's Mr. Wheeler, I believe. Okay.
That's correct. Mr. Wheeler, you can go ahead and unmute.
Hi, it's James Wheeler, General Manager of the Hayward Area Recreation and Park District. This is our, as stated earlier, this is our third trip back. I would tell you quite honestly, if we hadn't walked into that completely dilapidated and unsafe to live in house full of mold, we may not have bought it if we thought it had a historical consideration. It was doing nothing but rotting until we did. And we're happy to explore some of these possibilities, but I truly believe that I'm sorry for the history of Alameda County and its unwillingness to help you preserve a lot of these things that you've gone through in the last year. I've watched the White House and the other, or the White Cottage and some other things you've been going through. I just don't feel like this particular house with a second story roof that was added on, not an original monitor. And I think taking into account the report of our expert, you know, there may not be a certification in this, but he's our expert and he's telling us that, yeah, it's probably not a really great example of anything historically significant. I respect your right to disagree with that and vote however you want. But I do have to tell you, this is a little disappointing from our agency. Thank you.
Any other comments from the audience?
There are no additional raised hands.
We should vote on this. It is item one of our new business, but I withdrew my motion and I will leave it to the rest of the commissioners to make a motion regarding this property.
One more question. We asked for a peer review of from a county historical analysis, and I think we got one from the HARD, one of their historical analysis, and he mentioned that it was their historical analysis. And I saw something to the fact that there was no historical analysis. It was historical architects that were available to review this. Is that still the case or what happened there?
For clarification, I believe that request was for the Chouinard Barn, not this one.
I'm not hearing you.
That was the Chouinard Barn, I believe, that had two competing historical. I think just as a statement, this building probably would have been great if it were on the Alameda County Register, but because we are a commission of volunteers and Alameda County, unincorporated Alameda County, does not have any provisions for financing the restoration of historic properties in this part of our county. I'm going to say that my opinion is that it isn't the best example of historic property. Sadly, I think it, I wish it had been on the register, which would have protected it. But at this point, I would make a motion to approve the demolition of this particular property.
If we, and I'm getting the feeling that that's the way we're going to go, but there's a historical architectural building survey called the HABS report that analyzes the building, and this multi-page document that they gave is pretty close to a HABS report, but it tells and documents so that it's available to libraries and historians all over the area. I would like to see a HABS report done on it so that it's preserved and the people who live there and the surrounding area and how it developed and all that kind of stuff. I would motion if that would be approved by Linda. I would second the motion. Reluctantly.
Also, I would like to also point out that I think it's pretty unfortunate that an agency as large as HARG is making a purchase without any regard for the historic significance of property that it purchased. Apparently, there was no research on this. HARG brought the property, and it said if you had known that it was historic, maybe it would have been a different outcome. I don't. Ahead with the motion.
I heard a reluctant second to the motion, but can staff please read the motion as it has been stated?
As I understand the motion is to approve the demolition of the bungalow building with monitor on the property located at 1797 D Street.
It was seconded by Mr. Menard, but
requested a HABS report on it.
Are we modifying the motion to include an ABS report?
ABS.
Commissioner Menard, could you clarify what we would do with that report once it's completed?
Historical Architectural Building Survey, when I was in Fremont, we had one on... it was about a 300-page document that listed the houses and the people around it and all kinds of stuff. And it was on a Niles work in Niles, a tile work in Niles. And I think this is what I'm looking for, a rather complete HABS report. And there's people who do these, and they can be very complete. The people who do them oftentimes say, man, it was a lot of work, but when I got through, I really enjoyed what I learned. And I would like to see a HABS report done on this building and this property.
This be something that the Hayward Historical Society would benefit from having in their,
yes,
in their library?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Your addendum to this motion have any effect on the demolition of the no. building? No, you. So what you're asking for is a historical report, regardless of this.
The building, the neighborhood, the families that were involved, the history of the whole property and the area around it. Yes.
The conceivably the building could be demolished, but we would still have this report.
Yes.
Okay.
Would think that a lot of the report that's already been done would be pretty easy to add some detail to it to do that. It has a lot of information in here already about the history of the neighborhood and the history of Hayward, et cetera.
Very well. With this addendum, can you please read the motion back to us?
The motion is to approve the demolition of an existing bungalow building with monitor on the property located at 1797 D Street, subject to a HABS report, also known as a historical report.
So we have a motion. It's been seconded. It's been read back to us. Let's take a vote.
Commissioner Farley.
I'm going to abstain.
Commissioner Felix.
Aye.
Commissioner Menard.
Aye.
Commissioner Willis.
Aye.
And Chair Patterson.
Aye.
Motion passes.
Okay, then.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. After the meeting. Right. Thank you again for those members of HARD to and our historical. We'll go on to item two, the Ralph Brown Act, Ralph M. Brown Act, and Code of Conduct Training, Ethics Training Requirement Overview. I believe everyone on the commission should have a second PowerPoint. You have a raised hand. Are you ready?
Good afternoon. Yes.
Is the commission ready? Okay.
Okay. Fantastic. Good afternoon. My name is Melanie O'Brien. I'm a deputy county counsel with the county counsel's office. And I'll be giving this training today. If it's all right with you, I'm going to sit over here. It's a longer training. If you don't mind me not standing at the podium, I can see all of you pretty well. This training is intended to be for your commission, but of course the public is welcome to attend, and you'll take public comment just as it's a regular item. All right. I should also mention that we're going to start out with the Brown Act, and then we're going to go into some other issues that we've agendized for today's training. The bulk of this will be the Ralph M. Brown Act. All right. The guiding principle of the Brown Act, and I will say I recognize a few of you from a few years ago that I did this training for, so nice to see you again. This is probably going to be a repeat of what you've learned with maybe some small updates. So thank you for your patience. So the guiding principle of the Brown Act is the people's business must be conducted in public with ample opportunity for public participation. Who is subject to the Brown Act? Any board, commission, committee, or other body created by charter, ordinance, resolution, or other formal action of the Board of Supervisors. Your commission was created by action of the Board of Supervisors, making it subject to the Brown Act. So the Brown Act is governed by the open meeting rule. The rule is that meetings are open to the public. Exceptions to this rule are narrowly construed. All meetings of the legislative body of a local agency shall be open and public, and all persons shall be permitted to attend any meeting of the legislative body of a local agency. I should have mentioned this to start, but I'm fine with you asking questions as we go along. If something comes into your mind, just keep in mind that I might be telling you to hold off because that's addressed in a future slide. So something comes up based on the topic they're on, feel free to ask me a question and I can respond to it, or you can hold your questions to the end, whatever your preference is. So what is a meeting? A meeting occurs whenever a majority of the members of your commission or subcommittee of the commission come together at the same place and time. It's what we're doing right now. Meetings can be formal or informal. They can involve only a discussion or action or both in person or through technology.
Question for you back.
Sure.
Up on the meeting. If we met at a nonprofit organization like Hayward Area Historical Society, and there was four of us that met at that meeting, and that would have qualified for a quorum of this commission, although the Hayward Area Historical Society is a nonprofit and it be public announced, would that violate the Brown Act?
That actually falls into what I'll discuss in a later slide. That's an exception where you can, a quorum of you can go to a publicly noticed meeting that is open to the public, that is of interest to your body, and attend. I would caution you not to sit together, to be seen as if you're conducting the business of your body there. Just, make it look as above board as possible. But yes, you can do that under the Brown Act. It's an exception. Right. Meetings can include retreats, site visits, social gatherings, or networking before or after a noticed meeting. And when I say meeting, I don't mean legal meeting. I'm talking about what is a meeting, right? What would be a meeting under the Brown Act? So what is an unlawful meeting? Pre-meetings and post-meetings held without notice to the public, such as after this meeting, you go all into the parking lot and discuss subjects that are relevant to your commission. And serial meetings. So what's a serial meeting? Serial meetings often happen inadvertently. I'll go on to the serial meeting slide, sorry. You would hate to miss out on these graphics, right? Serial meetings can happen where one A talks to B, that's called the chain serial meeting, where A talks to B and then B talks to C and then C talks to D, right? So you're passing information inadvertently through a chain, or hub and spoke meetings, which are illegal serial meetings where A talks to B, A talks to C, A talks to D. The problem there is you're passing information along, essentially having a meeting of the minds, because you're giving each other's opinion or thoughts about decisions or information that's going to be coming before your commission.
Well, if we have information that we want to share with the rest of the board between meetings, then, and we send it to the secretary or the county offices, and what are they allowed to do with that information?
So you're talking about sending it through staff, right?
Yes.
So if you say, I want this to be part of an agenda, I'm interested in this topic, can it be added to the agenda? That's completely fine. But what you can't do with staff is say, I'm really interested in this topic. Can you tell the other members that I'm interested in this topic and here's how I feel about it, right? Where you're passing your opinions, your thoughts, your potential vote, and using staff as a conduit for your decisions. Does that make sense?
So if we pass information along, say, this bungalow, this house, this craftsman house we just had on the agenda, if I send information to staff that I was very much in favor of preserving this building, and how could that information get to, could that be included in a staff report to the commission at a public meeting, or would it just die and disappear?
You would want that opinion to be conveyed in public, right? That's so that the people have access to that opinion. You could tell Angelica, you could say, I really feel this way, but she is not to pass that on to the other commissioners, right? It's the act of passing the information on that becomes a Brown Act violation. Okay, how does serial meetings occur? Through text messages, emails, phone calls, and then through staff. The next slide will be I told you some good graphics. All right. Staff can answer questions or provide information to individual members so long as any views or positions expressed by the member are not communicated to other members. So they can tell you the time of the meeting. They could pass documents that are going to be on the agenda, right? So the public has access to those documents, but they're not to be used as a conduit for your opinions.
The question, and maybe we haven't gotten to that yet, but kind of back to what since Al was asking, we do a lot of research, obviously historic research on, what properties might be historic. We write a lot of letters to other agencies like the Castro Valley MAC or the Board of Supervisors. And so my understanding is because it's what, five members we have?
Well, we need for a quorum.
if two of us are researching something and trying to draft a letter, that that's okay to pass that back and forth?
Because it's not a quorum. So two people are working on this, not a quorum. And then you're bringing that to the noticed meeting, or are you giving that to people outside of the meeting?
Oh, we're bringing it to the noticed meeting to say, this is our draft. What do we think about it? Does this work? Does this make sense? And we discuss it, etc. We also might include, like we've included staff to, you know, at a date or something like that, some information that we don't have, and then also to format the final letter and send it out, et cetera. So I take it that that's...
I'm sorry, I'm distracted by his hand, but I'll say that that scenario sounds permissible because you're not having a meeting because there's not a quorum. You don't need really careful of serial meetings or of either one of you saying to another, you know, commissioner, this is what we're bringing. Oh, we're bringing that letter. Remember what I told you, right? You'd want to keep that very tight and very buttoned up. And the fact that you're putting it on the agenda, that you're going to be discussing that in the open meeting, makes it even more, you know, above board that this is for inclusion on your public meeting. But if four of you did that, I mean, I'm a big fan of keeping it to as low number of you talking about your business as possible, because just as I illustrated, you can have inadvertent serial meetings without meaning it.
Right.
But what you described does seem permissible, but taking precautions. To the mic. Sorry.
Well, we have subcommittees. They announce what members are going to be on the subcommittee. That is public when we're doing that. So everybody in the public knows that these members are going to be on that subcommittee. So technically, it's...
You didn't mention this was a subcommittee. Is it a subcommittee? Okay, that could be a problem, because then you have a quorum of your subcommittee. If there's a subcommittee, how many people are on it? That's a quorum of your subcommittee. You're having a meeting outside of the public meeting.
I don't understand how we're supposed to do our work if we can't talk to each other, do some research, draft a letter. That's kind of what we do. So
how can it be against the rules if it's made public? I don't get that.
Okay. Well, because that is a meeting that has to be noticed properly under the Brown Act if you're having a subcommittee meeting, right, with a quorum. There's different types of subcommittees. There's subcommittees that are formed by your body. There's standing subcommittees. That sounds like what it might be here. Or there's ad hoc subcommittees where the duration is fixed. It's for a specific purpose only, and it will end. Those ad hoc subcommittees are not subject to the Brown Act, but standing subcommittees are. And how can you do that work? You publish an agenda. You're going to have a subcommittee meeting. You allow the public to attend your subcommittee meeting.
Well, if we have two members working on a letter with staff involved, and then we bring that letter to the commission for approval, we are within the parameters of the Brown Act.
Unless it's a subcommittee where you have a quorum of a subcommittee.
So, okay, I'm sorry, but this is really confusing. So if we have an ad hoc, let's say we have one issue, we decide as a board that the next step in a process of bring a property, write a letter to another agency. Well, we create an ad hoc subcommittee, and the two people on that may need to talk back and forth by email or by phone call to say, you know, this is what we're working on. How can we put together a draft letter that can be reviewed by the full commission at the next meeting?
An ad hoc subcommittee is not subject to the meeting rules of the Brown Act, but an ad hoc subcommittee cannot be formed in reverse. You can't now say, oh, we meant this for this to be ad hoc. Like, you have to actually have your full commission form that ad hoc subcommittee. And when you form it, define what it's for and the duration that it'll last for, right?
Okay. At a commission, two members say, hey, we'll work together on a letter with staff for the purposes of bringing that letter back to the commission. That's an ad hoc committee.
The ad hoc committee subcommittee is something that you've all worked on and decided to form. So it's not you deciding individually or two of you deciding. So that is something that you are actually putting on your agenda as an item, an action item, formation of ad hoc subcommittee to do X, Y, and Z. You take it up at your full meeting, like if you had it on the agenda today, and you set the parameters around it.
Could we have examples of the different kind of committees just so we have a better definition? So when we're creating our committees, we can say, okay, we're following the rules because we're following this procedure or whatever.
There's only two types of subcommittees under the Brown Act that contemplates, which is a standing subcommittee that is subject to the Brown Act, and an ad hoc subcommittee, which is that limited purpose committee. So if you are looking to form one, you could reach out to staff, and I mean, they would reach out to me or somebody in my office, and they would walk you through the parameters and making sure you're setting that up correctly at your meeting.
We're looking at the possibility of doing a historical survey in Castle Valley. And so if we as a commission here decide that we want to put a couple of people on a long-term project of researching historic buildings in Castle Valley for the historical register, is that considered an ad hoc committee or a standing committee?
Well, it depends on how long that would last, what that project would entail. I'd have to know more about it to really understand. Is it something you could accomplish and have a singular purpose?
I'm doing a historical analysis for 3 years. Is 3 or 4 years make it a standing committee?
The longer it goes, the more it is more likely to be a standing subcommittee under the Brown Act.
Is there a time limit that says, okay, this is a standing committee, up until then it's an ad hoc committee?
No, they're two different animals because they're formed as a certain way. When they're formed either as ad hoc or standing. Standing never becomes ad hoc. Ad hoc never becomes standing. They're at their formation, they have their intent.
How do we make how do we form an ad hoc commission versus forming a standing commission?
How do you do that? You would put it on your agenda?
We just say we're going to form a standing committee to do X, Y, Z.
Exactly. And you would take a...
So we could only have, what, one person on a standing committee?
No, you could have as many people as you'd like to be on your standing committee.
Could it have the whole commission on it?
Yeah, I wouldn't know why you were forming a committee for the whole commission to be on it, but you could set the parameters of who wants to be on it.
And whenever we had a quorum, we could discuss it, but it would have to be publicly announced, right?
Yes.
An ad hoc committee, if we form an ad hoc committee, do we need to do public information that we are, as an ad hoc committee, is going to meet at Starbucks someplace and discuss a housing development or a historical resource or something?
You do not need to follow the meeting rules under the Brown Act for ad hoc committees. And that, you know, if you think about that, you know, it makes sense. Like, you're doing a narrow purpose for a limited amount of time. It's basically like a working group to get something done. But the more you meet, you know, you're having more of a standing committee where you have, you know, less of a defined purpose, less of a defined timeline. The public has a right to know what you're doing at those meetings. And I also want to say, regardless of whether you have an ad hoc committee or a standing subcommittee, your records, any emails you send, any text messages you send, are subject to the Public Records Act. So just because you have an ad hoc committee and you're not inviting people to Starbucks, as you said, it doesn't mean they can't have access to those text messages you sent about that if they file the public records request. So just keep that in mind. Need to move on?
It's quite a chill on her work, I have to say.
Okay. It is not a meeting. We touched on this a little bit earlier. Attendance of the majority at a regional, state, national conference, a local meeting that's open to the public, social, recreational, ceremonial events not sponsored by or for the body, birthday parties, you know, funerals, graduations, you all can go, but you cannot discuss the business of this commission at those events. And I'd caution you not to be all four or more of you sitting around whispering at the graduation party, right? This is so you can actually attend those events together because you all know each other, have friends, family in common.
With text phones, it's pretty easy to communicate with one another without being in close proximity. What I'm concerned about is Hayward Area Historical Society at one time was involved with the San Lorenzo Cemetery. This commission has been involved with the San Lorenzo Cemetery. If the San Lorenzo Cemetery is on the agenda for the Hayward Area Historical Society, and two or three of us decide to go and make our hear what they're saying about it, and one other person comes in, and if the meeting's public announced, is that okay or is it not okay?
The meeting is open to the public. It's okay.
Open to the public, and we don't sit close to each other and don't whisper in each other's ears. We're okay.
Right. And the statute doesn't say anything about whispering or sitting close to each other. That's my just advice to you, to just make it look as above board as possible if a quorum of you are going to go to a public event.
So, and we can make comments at a public event.
Look, comment?
Yes.
Yes.
On behalf of the commission.
I mean, I would not do that on behalf of
as an individual.
Right. As an individual, the second you say I'm speaking on behalf of this commission, you're conveying your viewpoints. Right. So you're doing this as an individual for your own personal interest. Those things matter because the issue becomes, are you providing your opinions to the other, you know, rest of the commissioners in the room? About what
so you if when you go to it, like I go to a lot of other commission meetings. So, and I might say, sometimes I go on business that they've asked for, you know, information from the. But if I go to something and say I'm on the Parks Recreation Historic Commission, but I am not speaking on behalf of the commission, I'm speaking as member, et cetera, that.
Well, I would say keep it as an individual if there's a quorum of you in the room, and not make your opinions about the business of this body. So if it's within the subject matter of this commission, and you're going in a quorum of your peers, and they're sitting there in the room at this public meeting, and you're giving public comment about what you think, and that is under the purview of this commission, you're communicating your viewpoints with them. So I would take caution when there's a quorum. There are probably places you go by yourself or maybe sure. with.
If I go by myself, let's say I live in Castro Valley, so I have a lot of things that we're talking about are things that I'm personally interested in as a community member. So I need to, guess what I need to say, do I need to say I'm on this commission, but I'm speaking as a community member, not on behalf of the commission, or should I just not even mention that I'm on the commission and just say I'm a community member, and it's my opinion?
That's up to you. My main concern is whether there's a quorum of your right. Fellow commissioners there.
Okay.
Good. Usually she goes by herself. Yeah. Okay. We did go to one meeting because we were advocating for stuff to be on the historical committee, and we discussed that in a public meeting when we did it. And then we went and we discussed, and they know we're part of the commission, so we explained our title.
You were at the Board of Supervisors.
Right, the Board of Supervisors, and we were discussing putting on why our reasoning was for putting on the historical, and this was a decision made by all of us, and whoever could attend would attend.
I think that makes sense in that case when you're saying this is something that already happened, that we've already taken up, right?
Right.
That's a little bit different, and you're...
And
you're giving,
it was on video, the Board of Supervisors, the board recognized each member, Linda and James, individually, as representing or as members of the commission.
And different here even more is that your job is to make recommendations to the Board of Supervisors.
Okay, I have another question. So in terms of, I'm going to take everyone's time, but in terms of writing letters, for instance, so I... if I ask a question to Angelica's office, you know, what time is the next meeting of another body that we need to attend or something, then I also have be president of the So he knows. Is that not appropriate, or?
I don't see that as a violation.
More questions before you go running away.
I'll be right here.
If I were sitting over there, I'd be looking for the door.
Really?
Number one, what's the penalties for violating the Brown Act?
I'll get to that. Is it okay if I...
Okay, yeah. I'll skip that then for right now. You mentioned that if we have a discussion, if James and I go and sit in a Starbucks someplace and discuss something that we're going to bring up to this commission at some time as a part of an ad hoc committee that has been recognized by the commission, what do we do with those documents that we write up, and what are we required to deposit them, send them to staff or idle? What do we do with them?
So are you saying that in this situation, you've formed an ad hoc subcommittee, correct? And you're meeting together.
Right.
Your decision on what to do with those records would really be governed by what your commission decides to do. Like, they expecting a report from you? I mean, you know, if you it's up to you if you want to, you know, destroy every record after every meeting. There's no rule about that in the Brown Act. But it would be what the commission expects of you. Maybe they're expecting an update, or, you know, written update, a report, which would be later published on the agenda as an update as to what the ad hoc committee did.
We need to, it would be recommended that we submit a report on what our end result was, not necessarily what each of us said individually up until the time we made the end report.
It's truly up to the commission when they form the ad hoc committee to say, this is what we expect from them. And when we expect it by, right? That's sort of what goes into the thought process of what this ad hoc committee is going to do. Or you might say, you know, at a meeting after you've met, update from ad hoc committee on the agenda, right? And you say, we'd like to issue a report. This is an update. Well, a report will be coming to you. You know, you can agendize that.
Sorry, question. I'm in one district. Another member is in a different district, and we meet at Starbucks. Unbeknownst to the commission, is that appropriate or not? Is that legal under the Brown Act? And we begin to discuss an item that has been on the agenda previously, but we meet at Starbucks.
Two of you at Starbucks, right?
Correct.
Okay, not a quorum, not a meeting. You can discuss what you wish, with a strong, you know, word of caution from me not to pass on anything that you've discussed or said to any other commissioners, which create a serial meeting inadvertently, right?
Okay.
Because then the next day, I saw Jim at Starbucks. You know, he was telling me something. You see how this can go, right? So it's, you want to exercise caution. And I honestly, if I were you, I'd say, you, this is just, you're not going to pass this on, right? We got to make sure we keep this close because we don't want a Brown Act violation.
If we make a if we have this meeting and we decide that it's important enough that we could make a report, should make a report, even though we've not been designated as an ad hoc subcommittee, is it okay to make a report to the full commission saying we met at such and such a place and discussed such and such an item, and this is the decision we came to?
I suppose if you would want to do that, you would talk to the chair about putting that on the agenda and presenting your ideas.
If it was on the agenda, say we had set the agenda, we've got some things on the agenda that have been ongoing for a long time, and we keep coming back to them. If one of those is on the agenda and we meet and discuss it, although we haven't been formed into an ad hoc committee, and then we decide that, yeah, this is a better idea to do it than option B, are we required to bring it to the committee? If we bring it to the commission, what's the deal?
You're not required to.
Not required to.
Right.
But if we bring it to the commission, then what?
You put it on the agenda and discuss it in open forum.
Even if it's already on the agenda, we can still discuss it on open forum.
Right. That's how you would agendize that if you had a topic you wanted to discuss or have staff bring a report about or something.
Thank you.
All right, social media, because of course you can have a Brown Act violation using social media as well. The Brown Act applies to internet-based social media platforms. This includes Twitter/X, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok. But a good caveat here is a meeting does not include a member engaging in a separate conversation or communication on a social media platform to answer questions, provide information to, or solicit information from the public regarding a matter within the subject matter jurisdiction of the legislative body. Sorry, long way of saying an individual can talk to the public on social media. It's not a Brown Act violation if you do that. But
if they do a blog, then that becomes a violation?
A blog?
Yeah. If they have a discussion group on
the thread, yeah.
On YouTube or something like that, and they're talking about historical preservation in unincorporated Alameda County, does that become a violation?
Depends who's talking.
Bus.
Right. So if this is the next slide. Which I think is important to keep in mind that the difference between text and email is it's pretty straightforward. But with social media, we have all of these different interfaces of how to communicate. So that can include comments or liking something. So if one of you makes a post on social media on Facebook, like I'm going to vote this way on this building demolition item, and then you all like it, you just had a meeting, right? Or three more of you like it. That's a quorum. That's a meeting. So social media needs to be used carefully, right? And we also don't want to inadvertently like something and we didn't know that, you know, three more commissioners were coming down to like a post, right? Which is a meeting. You're conveying to the public how you feel about something. So use caution with social media. But you can, if a member of the public reaches out to you on social media and says, what time's your meeting? Can you send me the agenda? Yes, you can do that, right? But it's more about inadvertent creation of meeting on social media.
So if you guys want to be my friends on Facebook, I block you.
I don't know if that would help, because if you were blocking them, they could still like the things that you liked and then you just wouldn't know. You would just have plausible deniability, but still creating a potential problem. All right. So meeting rules, meetings must be held within Alameda County. They must occur at a time and place set by ordinance, resolution, bylaws, or other rule of the body. I'm going to get into teleconferencing. This is a little bit of a tricky issue and I'll go through it, but what I'm going to call original teleconferencing, and then I'll call it just cause and emergency circumstances teleconferencing. Original teleconferencing has been around for a while now. Pre-pandemic, we got just cause emergency circumstances with the pandemic. So what's a teleconference? It's a meeting of the legislative body, the members of which are in different locations connected by electronic means, either through audio or video or both. So let's talk about traditional teleconferencing rules. Traditional teleconferencing is, like I said, this was around pre-pandemic. People or commissioners could appear using the traditional teleconferencing rules when they could not get to the physical location of the meeting. So if you want to appear using traditional teleconferencing rules, each teleconference location must be identified in the notice and agenda. So if I'm traveling and I'm in Missouri and I'm going to be in a library in Missouri, and I want to use traditional teleconferencing where I can attend the meeting using teleconference, on this agenda that you have that we've posted on the door here, you have to put the address of that Missouri library so the public can potentially go there and attend the meeting with you. Each location must have public access. So if you're using traditional teleconference and you want to use it at home, you have to think to yourself, is my home ADA compliant? Can a wheelchair get in my home? Would people be comfortable in my home? Because the public gets an opportunity to be in your teleconference location. And the public must have an opportunity to speak at each location. So that means you're sharing your laptop, you're sharing your technology, so you can pass that on to the member of the public to speak there if they so choose. This is, of course, while the regular meeting is happening here too. In order to use this, a quorum must be within the county, and all votes must be taken by roll call. I've noticed that you guys were taking, you were taking votes by roll call this evening. I don't believe there's any teleconferencing right now for any commissioner. So that means you don't need to take votes by roll call. It's sufficient to do the ayes and the nays, but we do that to be formal at times. But if somebody's teleconferencing, votes are to be taken by roll call, okay? All right.
Question about that. Since we do have public access via teleconferencing, be appropriate to vote by the way we have been voting? People are, they might be listening. They may not raise their hand, but they may be listening.
Teleconferencing rule applies to when one of you is using teleconferencing to attend, but you're welcome to continue doing things this way. It's very clean. It's probably great for minute taking as well. I'm just pointing that out as a difference. So,
more question. I break a leg and I'm stuck at home, but I break it Thursday morning and the meeting is Thursday afternoon and I'm stuck at home. Can I notify the secretary or the staff that I'm going to be teleconference from home? And is that appropriate, or do I have to cancel the meeting? And say I'm there's only three commissioners and we need a fourth, and I make the fourth one. Am I legal, even though I have just given a couple hours notice?
And you just put me, that's a perfect setup for the next slide, right? Because there are new rules that speak to this very issue. So traditional teleconferencing, that means that well in advance, I knew I was going to Missouri, that's on the agenda, published 72 hours in advance, right? So we have AB 2449, us lawyers love to use the bill names. And this was effective January 1st, 2023, which eliminated the requirement of a state of emergency for you to attend by teleconference. But has the following requirements for two different types of teleconferencing. And I know this is going to be the biggest letdown ever, but what I'm telling you right now, it expires at the end of the year. And there's new legislation that is likely going to be passed that is going to change some of this. And we're going to use different words potentially starting next year. So you're learning something that is good for 3 months. And if there is a significant change, we'll make sure you have that information. But right now, pretend I didn't tell you that caveat. So to not use the traditional teleconferencing rules, you use just cause or emergency circumstances. In order to do that, there must be a quorum that meets in person in the body's jurisdiction for either of these. So that means that you break your leg. Okay, you're going to use you could probably use just cause or emergency circumstances. I'll get into the qualifiers with those. But that means you need to make sure that we have four of you sitting here for the physical location for to use one of those exceptions, right? A quorum has to be here. You can still attend by teleconference as a fifth person, but if only three people can make it to the physical location, you're not going to be able to use that teleconferencing attendance. So if you're going to be using just cause or emergency circumstances, you have to use both video and audio on whatever device you're using to attend the meeting. Traditional teleconferencing is just audio, no video required. But if you're doing just cause emergency circumstances, video and audio. And you also have to announce if there's anybody 18 years or older with the member and identify that person and their relationship to the member that's in the room with you. So I'll go through what just cause and emergency circumstances are. There's some overlap, which is why the legislator is trying to merge these two with this new bill that hopefully passes. So with just cause, it's defined as childcare or caregiving for a child, parent, grandparent, grandchild, sibling, spouse, or domestic partner that requires remote participation, a contagious illness that prevents the member from attending in person, a need related to a disability not otherwise accommodated, such as a broken leg, travel while on official business of the legislative body or state or local agency, or a state or local agency. You can only use this 2 times in a calendar year, and approval by the commission is not required. So you don't have to get a vote for this. The reason for the teleconferencing using just cause needs to be disclosed on the record. You do not need to say, you know, anything personal about your health. You can just say, I have a disability that cannot be accommodated by the physical location. You do not need to say what the contagious illness is. Sufficient just to say contagious illness. And it must be a request made at the most reasonable opportunity. So you break your leg. Let's say it's what's today. You break your leg last night, Wednesday night. It's sufficient for you to email the chair on Thursday morning. Broken leg, got to attend by teleconference, like just letting you know, right?
Along that line, you say you only get 2 exclusions on just cause in a year, calendar year?
Yes.
And say I'm familiar with a gentleman who was a military person working on the Ohlone School Board. And he was in Washington, D.C. about half the time, and he was teleconferencing from Washington, D.C. almost every month. Now, he may not have made the quorum, but he was teleconferencing in. So if he makes an announcement of that in advance and can set it up, is that it's just the emergency one that's asked to only 2 times a year?
That sounds more like traditional teleconferencing.
Okay.
So there's no reason for the traditional teleconferencing. You don't have to state a reason, but you have to plan ahead 72 hours in advance.
Okay.
Right. So emergency circumstances, it's just like it seems, is defined as a physical or family medical emergency that prevents a member from attending in person. There's no specific limit on the number of times emergency circumstance can be used, but the annual cap generally limits the use, which I'll get into in just a second. The remote participation due to emergency circumstances must be specifically approved by the legislative body as an action item. I love that they made these different. So if you are in an emergency, you do need actual action by your commission to have the permission to attend by teleconference. A request can be added to an agenda and must be acted on at the beginning of the meeting. The member must provide a general description of the emergency. The description not needed to exceed 20 words and shall not require the member to disclose any medical diagnosis or disability or any personal medical information exempt under existing law. So emergency is treated differently right now on the books than just cause. And like I said, they're merging these two definitions now, trying to fix that up because it is a little bit strange that some of this is, you know, some of it requires action by the body, some of it not. Is you saying, you know, more information than not. It's probably needlessly complicated, and hopefully they'll fix that and it'll start in 2026. And if that law does pass, it'll take us to 2030, which would be very nice.
In emergency circumstances here, I didn't see anything that said that you could only do it twice a year. The other one said...
The next slide.
On next line.
Well, of course, they made this complicated as well for emergency circumstances, which is no more than 3 consecutive months of teleconferencing and no more than 20% of the meetings per calendar year.
Oh. January, I break my leg. February, I get COVID.
Okay.
January, my wife's in the hospital. I've exceeded it, right?
Which one did you use? It would depend on, you know, so if you broke your leg, I'm not sure if that's an emergency depending on the day it happened, right? Sounds like just cause. COVID sounds like just cause. What happened to your wife?
Between cause and emergency.
For now. For the next 3 months, yes.
Have any idea what's going to be on it after the year?
I don't. I believe there's the decision deadline is the 12th of October. So, you know, something to look forward to. Right.
Who will let us know? Or
yeah, I'll let all my clients know, and they can also inform your commission. And I'm truly hopeful that it will be simplified, and that we could just give you a chart so you could understand the differences.
In other words, James here could have telecommuted, right.
something
like that. I could have, yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Forum.
So the difference between these two, you know, just cause emergency circumstances and traditional teleconferencing is you do not have to let the public into your home when you're using just cause or emergency circumstances. We're not putting that on the agenda. They don't even know where you are, right? That's because you've been through this situation that needs protecting. But traditional teleconferencing, you need to let the public wherever that address is on the agenda and accommodate them. And just to say this, you can also not attend a meeting. You know, this doesn't make it so you have to attend. This is just a way for you to attend if something bad has happened. Any more questions on teleconferencing? Okay, we're going to go into something a little bit more dry. All right, written material. So written material relating to the agenda, writings related to open session agenda items of a regular meeting that are distributed to all or the majority of all of the members less than 72 hours before the meeting must be made available for public inspection at the time of distribution to all or the majority of all of the members. And writings can be available for public inspection by internet posting and physical copies available at designated office and meeting location. For instance, this PowerPoint, I gave you all copies, nice color ones too, at the beginning of the meeting. And I immediately went and put copies for the public here because that was when it was distributed to all of you. And that's when it triggered the right of the public to have that.
You didn't give us 72 hours notice.
I don't have to.
No, because you gave it to the public.
Yeah.
Ah.
So I have a question. So back to these draft letters. Do those have to be available for the public to see before we discuss a draft of something, or do they only final put it on there?
The agenda item is review or consider a letter to X, Y, and Z. It should be attached to the agenda so the public knows what you're considering. Okay, distribution of writings. If a writing that is a public record is distributed during the meeting and it was prepared by staff or the members of the body, it must be made available at the meeting. If it was prepared by some other person, it must be made available after the meeting. So if a member of the public has something that all of you received at the meeting, it's fine for staff to upload that after the meeting. It doesn't have to be done right away. The notice and agenda. Regular meeting agendas must be posted 72 hours in advance of the meeting, and special meeting agendas only require 24 hours advance notice. I'll go into the differences between regular and special meetings. Teleconference meetings require posting at each remote location 72 hours or 24 hours, depending on what type of meeting it is. So that means that if you decide that your home is a place for a teleconference, you need to post an agenda outside 72 hours prior to the meeting. Or like, remember my example of going to Missouri, I'm going to have that meeting in that library. I need to have somebody at that library post the agenda to have it out there 72 hours in advance. So if you're traveling, you can certainly attend by teleconference, but keep in mind the agendas need to be posted wherever you are 72 hours in advance. So get cozy with the hotel staff or something like that, if that's what you intend to do.
You're staying at a hotel and you don't know what room you're going to get in a hotel. Where do you post the notice? On the front door of the hotel or on your room or where?
This is beyond my, you know, it depends where you're having it, right? That's what you would do. So if you don't know your room number, I don't think you can post an agenda meeting there yet. You can't have a teleconference there.
And have a teleconference then?
If you can't post it at their accurate place within 72 hours prior.
You can't teleconference.
Well, because you didn't comply with the Brown Act.
If you are teleconference, but you're not commenting, you're just listening to what's being said and making no comments. Is that teleconferencing?
You're not attending the meeting, like you weren't counted in roll call, you were excused.
Yeah, let's say it was that way. But you've got your computer with you and you're there and you're watching the meeting go on to get it and you're taking notes of what's happening.
That's fine. You're not a part of that meeting, but that's fine. You can do that. That's not teleconferencing. Teleconferencing is you being in the roll call, you're making votes. Motions.
You're saying that you're there and you're commenting on the items as they come up.
Right. Exactly. Okay. So agendas must describe each item to be considered in enough detail that a person of ordinary intelligence could determine whether the item is of interest. This is really important that your agendas have some specificity to what you're intending to discuss or what your action is going to be, because you want the public to be able to make an informed decision if they should be going to that meeting, right? So a vague agenda description does not necessarily put them on notice of what you intend to do.
So an item that it may be voted up or down has to be identified as an action item, even if maybe you're going to table it?
I don't think I understand the question.
There's some items on our agenda that we are reporting on a monthly basis. And we decide that we're going to move forward on this because it's on the agenda. We can. Do we have to note on the agenda items that it's a possible agenda item, action item?
You should specify if it's an action item or informational item.
Okay.
And you're not required to take action on action items, that you can continue them or say we're not taking action on this, right? But so the public knows, oh, this could be potential action. But you could never have an informational item that you've noticed as informational that would become an action item at the meeting. All right. I've already said this essentially, but a body subject to the Brown Act may not discuss or may not act on items not on the agenda or that are beyond the reasonable scope of the agenda description. So you can't act or do or have an item that is not listed on the agenda. Pretty straightforward. Things that do not need to be on the agenda, commendations, announcements, request to agendize future items. So you can make a request to staff that you'd like to see that on the agenda for a future date. Limited follow-up to general public comment to provide information or direction to staff. So you are allowed to do that. You're never, and we'll talk about public comment in just a second, but you are never obligated to engage with any member of the public or to respond to their questions.
If we do, no, so we often have some very involved members of the public who send us emails and ask questions, asking us to. Really, I do. Is that a problem?
It could become a problem depending on what you're doing, but I don't. It's hard for me to address that generally. We do. The issue becomes if you're engaging with one member of the public over another, right? That can be an issue. But also if you're having a conversation with a member of the public, it can go off agenda. Like it can quickly devolve into something specific that was not necessarily a topic of the agenda that day. So,
So generally, I mean, these aren't emails that I've asked people to send me, we want to point out we were talking about this issue and they might say to me, did you know that this was also important to this topic? There's trees on the property or something else, or this is a history that we didn't know about in the meeting that they want to add to this. But
it's up to you how you want to handle that. Your role as a commissioner is you don't necessarily need to say, I was talking to X, Y, and Z, or I heard this from X, Y, and Z. You can say, I have concerns about this, right? I mean, there's various ways that you can filter this through your own viewpoints. So the public, we can move on to the next slide, which...
You get there. I've been dealing with these commissioners a long time, and I'm confused most of the time on the Brown Act. James is sitting right alongside of me here, and I point to something on your agenda and say, whisper in your ear and I say, I'm going to vote no on this. Is that a violation of the Brown Act?
Is in a public meeting?
During a meeting.
You shouldn't do that during a meeting because then the public doesn't have access to what you're saying. You should always be speaking into the microphone, making sure that it's lit, because we need people online to be able to listen. And you cannot convey your viewpoints during a meeting that the public can't hear. And frankly, if I were staffing this, I would say, I just heard you say something. Can you make sure you repeat that so the public can hear? Because it's that's their right.
With the hot mic, that's...
Sure. So the rights of the public to have meetings open in public with limited exceptions, to have access to all agendas or public meetings and documents distributed to the legislative body members, to audio video record the meetings and to inspect recordings of the meetings made by the agency, to attend without precondition. For example, you can't mandate that they give their names or register to speak. They can pick whatever name they wanted. They could say that they're Mariah Carey or Dumbo or whatever, that's their name. You can't make them say where they're from. That's the right. So there's different types of public comment. Specific public comment, those are items that are on the agenda that you take up at time of the consideration of that item. And general public comment, which is any time within the commission's subject matter jurisdiction, I'm sorry, any item within the commission's subject matter jurisdiction, but not listed on the agenda. I haven't studied your agenda, but I think you had public comment, general public comment at the very beginning, open forum, and that's for items not on the agenda. Those comments are always going to be limited, though, to items under your purview, not somebody, you know, raising a stink about the Starbucks closing, right? That wouldn't be within your jurisdiction. So, and you do have a right to tell people like, oh, that's not something we can help you with, and stop them if it's outside of your jurisdiction.
I'd just like to say for the record that Pete's exists as well.
Right. Yeah. We all have to support Pete's now. Yeah.
There's many coffee shops other than Starbucks. We can meet.
And general comments that are not on the agenda. I've been under the basic rule that you don't discuss them other than maybe ask for clarification of what they're talking about, but you don't give any indication whether you're going to approve or disapprove or want to put it on agenda or anything else. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. You want to be especially careful with that because there's nothing on the agenda that speaks to what they're talking about. So specific public comment, it's an opportunity for the public to address the commission members on any agenda item, discussion, information, or action items. It must occur before conclusion of consideration of the items. That's for a discussion or informational item, or before action is taken on an action item. General public comment may occur at any time in the meeting at the discretion of the chair or commission by majority. You've put it on your agenda already. It is limited to matters within the scope of the commission's jurisdiction, even if not on the agenda. Members may not discuss or respond substantively. It's also not required at special meetings. So special meetings are meetings that have a determined amount of items or item on them, no general public comment, and they can be held 24 hours in advance. I don't think that your commission often holds special meetings, but it's an option to you if something comes up and is urgent and needs to be heard before the next regular meeting date. So something to keep in mind.
Good question. If somebody comes in and wants to speak at open session or during the meeting and say something that's irrelevant, that's not on it, that's derogatory, that's whatever, is negative in every aspect, is there any way we can shut them up?
We'll go to the next slide for this. You're cueing me right up again. So the rights of the speaker, they have a right to equal time. They have a right to criticize policy, body, its members, its staff. We do have an abusive conduct policy, which I'll be talking about, and the speaker cannot be disruptive. So a reasonable, I'm going to satisfy your question in just a second. Up to a reasonable amount of time is usually 2 to 3 minutes. Speaker, whatever you determine is reasonable here. there can be a reasonable limit put on the total public comment time before or during the public comment. If it's excessive, you've got people out the door, like, you know, you're here until 10 p.m. You can say, you know, we'll do 50 speakers, 1 minute each. That's totally within the purview of your body. And then, like I've said, there's no right to a response from the body, its members or staff to the public. So controlling unruly speakers, nice little art here. The chair may impose reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions on public participation. Unruly speakers may be excluded from the forum if necessary to allow business to continue. And first, a warning must be given. So you cannot just say, first of all, you can never say, I don't like what you said. You know, your opinion is, you know, not wanted here, right? That's not going to work. They have a right to their opinions. If they're using obscenities or they're being disruptive, you should give them a warning. You know, that conduct's not going to be tolerated. You'll be asked to leave if you continue, right? The warning must be given. But this is a higher standard here. So it says they may be excluded from the forum if necessary to allow business to continue, right? So that means that if they're in their seat and they're, you know, saying, you're calling you all sorts of swear words, but they're whispering, I don't know if that really infringes on your ability to, you know, run the meeting as much as somebody screaming, throwing things, threatening, right? You use your discretion, but it's not so much as simple as like they did one thing bad and now they're just kind of muttering to themselves in a chair, right? You have to say that, well, we couldn't have continued our business but for this.
So for example, if someone is interrupting a speaker constantly with questions, that would not be...
look at me.
That would not be considered unruly behavior.
I wouldn't think so.
I was in a meeting where the people came up and they started singing, and that really disrupted because the whole entire group started singing and nobody could really do anything. It was like we just had to wait there until they stopped.
And also, you know, you have to take, I mean, into the practical aspect of, is it just going to inflame the situation if you threaten them? Will they just stop eventually? Right. We want to make sure everybody's safe. So it's something that's up to your discretion, but it can't just be a mere annoyance. Right. So violations of the Brown Act, why do we care? One violation, which we didn't talk about here, is disclosure of closed session discussions. Closed session is when you're going to be meeting with a lawyer from my office about a certain item outside of the public. It's for very specific reasons. Don't believe it applies to your commission. If it does, you'd know it. But any items that you've discussed in closed session with county counsel's office are confidential, they're privileged. And if you disclose those, there are penalties under the Brown Act. The Brown Act really requires a willful violation. So you know, knowing or recklessly share information, or you have unlawful meetings, that's in violation of the Brown Act, where the member intends to deprive the public of information to which the public is entitled. So that is that's an overt act, essentially, by one of you. You know, people make mistakes, and there's things that you can do to correct your mistakes. If you realize that you've made a violation, you would get in touch with staff, they'd get in touch with my office, and we would figure it out. There are some safe harbor laws, too, that if you try to correct your mistake and you get a certain amount of time to do that in. So it's not something where you, if you do it accidentally, that it necessarily means like swift liability, but it is something to correct and to fix. And a violation of the Brown Act is a misdemeanor. So nobody wants to go to jail for that. An additional penalty of the Brown Act is voiding of the action taken that was in violation. So starting at square one, which can mean anybody that gave you recommendations that you relied on. You'd have to go back to them. You'd have to go back to you. You'd have to go back to the board, right? All of these steps, and, you know, beyond annoying, to make sure that the public had access to the reasoning for your decision, because this was taken away from them. So we want to avoid doing that. Potential injunctive or declaratory relief to stop or prevent violations of the Brown Act. That's pretty extreme. And then the prevailing plaintiff may receive attorney fees and costs. I don't know if you know anything about civil litigation, but those can be pretty hefty. So if we violate the Brown Act and get sued, we could be on the hook for quite a lot of money.
I Brown Act online review, and they pointed out that at a commission meeting, something like this, or a city council meeting, a person on way down on one end was with their laptop computer, was working their laptop computer and looking over at the person on the other end, and they were looking back and smiling at them and typing on their computer. And they called that a violation of the Brown Act because they were communicating with one another, and it was pretty obvious that they were. And so the whole action was denied. They had to start over from square one again. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Because you're, you know, obfuscating, just like whispering, using technology to convey your point away from the public so they can see it as, you know, illegal. I am going to move on from the Brown Act. Unless you have more Brown Act questions, we're going to go through some different things.
I have some legal questions that I think are related to the Brown Act, and at least interacting with the public. So if I ask those questions, you say they're not relevant, that's fine. But is this a good time to ask them? Or
I mean, are they related to this presentation? Or
I think so. But can I just ask you the questions? And sure. Then if you decide that they're not appropriate, that's fine too. So the first question I had, is it okay to share documents in the meeting, like what we got today, this historical report? Can I pass it on to the Hayward Historical Society or anybody else? It sounds like I can.
That's a public record.
Okay. Second question. Can we meet with like our county supervisor, county representatives, board of supervisors, people to explain an action or to advocate that they vote in favor of something? So for instance, we have buildings that are on the register that the county needs to vote on whether they want to pay the money to restore those properties. We've sent a letter already, so we've taken an action. They know, the supervisor knows what's in it if that person has read it. Can we, you know, meet with that supervisor, say, I'd like to see if you have any questions about what we wrote, and we hope that you will vote, you know, to provide the funding for this project.
My answer to that completely depends on how many of you are meeting with a supervisor.
Each of us. So if I meet with my supervisor, somebody in the next one meets with that person. So we do it separately.
Me, that creates a serial meeting. Yeah, it's a chain meeting. A, B, C, D, right? You're like, you're going to go do this. I'm going to do this. You're going to do this. Like, you're creating that. You're all talking to each other to go do that outside of an open meeting.
We're not talking to each other. I'm just saying as a citizen can meet with my supervisor anytime that I want. But since I have sent, or our commission has sent a letter to the supervisor, and I'd like to meet with you. If you have any questions about this letter that was sent from the commission, I'm that, you know, you will consider this, you know, to vote what this letter has asked you to do. The letter said, you know, this is important. These buildings need to be repaired. You know,
I understand. Here's my issue. Are you saying this in an open meeting that each of you is going to go meet with your supervisors?
You did not.
Okay. So if you're doing it outside of an open meeting and you're coordinating that each of you would meet with each of your supervisors, that creates an unlawful meeting.
We're in a commission meeting and a commissioner discusses and suggests that we each meet with our direct report, our supervisor, regarding a matter that has been on the agenda and a letter that has been approved that's on the agenda. That's okay?
As long as that's happening in an open meeting, the coordination is more of my concern outside of that. Like, does that make sense?
Really? Okay. No, it okay. Does not.
So in other words, we haven't said we're all going to go to our supervisors and ask them XYZ things. We just said We've written a letter. We wanted to offer to meet with our supervisor and see if they have any questions about this. We wrote to them.
Distinction here that I'm making is that if you say in an open meeting, I think it would be a good idea for all us all to meet with our supervisors and let them know how important this is. Meeting adjourned, you go do that individually, one-on-one, fine. But after the meeting, if you say, hey, did you go meet with a supervisor? Make sure that he goes and meets with the supervisor before this happens. There's a date. That's when it becomes you guys are meeting outside of the, that's the chain meeting that I'm talking about.
That has
about.
Not happened, so.
Okay.
Okay.
On follow up on that question, I wrote a letter just today to Supervisor Halbert, Kathy Kimblin, who's a Fremont rep for Supervisor Halbert. She wrote back and said, yes, this is a good idea. I would da 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 da. You need to contact Supervisor Miley because I think that's in his district. Now, if I write the same letter or a similar letter to the other supervisor, is that a serial meeting that's held out? Because we talked about possibly contacting our supervisors while we were in open meeting, but we didn't say, oh, I'm going to contact so-and-so and so-and-so about this issue. So where is it a social meeting? Where is it an open meeting? When is it a closed meeting? When is it illegal? And when is it legal?
In that situation, you're the only person that is talking to either of the district offices, right?
Yes.
So then that's not a problem. The problem becomes when a majority of you, four of you, are talking outside of an open forum about what you're going to do.
But if I send a letter on the issue and Linda sends a letter to the same supervisors on the same issue, and somebody else sends a letter to the same supervisor or different supervisors on the same issue, is that a violation?
Not as you've said it to me, unless you have discussed outside of a meeting that you intended to do that as a group, right? That's the issue, is the outside of the meeting discussion.
Okay, so if we say we're going to contact our supervisors in a public meeting like this and we contact them, even if we contact two or three of them, it's still legal, right? Supervisors.
Right, right. The issue isn't with talking with the supervisors. You could change this supervisor to anything you wanted to, right? Talking with any specific person or persons. The issue is whether or not you have had conversations constituting an illegal meeting outside of an open meeting about intending to do that, your plans to do that. That's the issue. Okay.
One more question. We have very few members of the public who attend our meetings. One, because there's no notice in our local papers that we have these meetings. Our supervisors were going to list it in their, you know, annual, their monthly report that we have these meetings at this time. That hasn't happened. I wanted to know if we can submit just a general article in a local paper saying this thing is going to happen, give it a history, you know, this building is just going to be a meeting about this building, this is why it's historic, if you want to attend, the meeting will happen at such and such a date. Is that okay to do?
Part of that is not a Brown Act question, but I also take issue with potentially under the Brown Act, if one of you were to put that in the paper and say, this is why this is historic, is a communication that all of you could read, right? It's like you're saying your point. It's one thing to say our meeting is on X date, right? But saying, I want to put this in the paper and I wanted to say this opinion is a different issue. But as far as your purview, like of whether you can put something in the paper, I don't know the answer to that. And that's not in the Brown Act.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I'm going to move on to some, I think, more simple. We'll see what you think, which is that, okay, the Board of Supervisors has enacted a new code and policy relating to the behavior of county employees and or county bodies. I'm going to go over those pretty quickly. One is the Code of Ethics. This is for board and commission members. The other is the Abusive Conduct Prevention Policy. The code of ethics is codified. In 2024, County of Alameda adopted a code of ethics for all board and commissions. The goal is to ensure that promoting the common good is the hallmark of the decision-making process for all. There are 16 maxims for achieving this goal that are codified. I am just going to highlight these few, which pertain to your work. Actively promote public confidence in county government through your actions. Recognize and support the public's right to know the public's business. Involve residents in the decision-making process and welcome divergent points of view. Respond to the public in ways that are complete, clear, and easy to understand. Be a good listener, carefully considering all opinions and points of view. Comply with all local laws and regulations applicable to an appointed official and those governing the conduct of meetings. So those are things to keep in mind that were adopted and codified in our county code for commissions to follow.
Does that mean that we are required to take ethics training?
I'm going to get to the ethics training.
Okay.
Okay.
Keep jumping the gun.
All right. So the County of Alameda adopted an abusive conduct prevention policy. This was, I believe, last year when it was formally adopted. You should have gotten a copy of this. If you did not get a copy of it, please reach out to staff and they can give you a copy of the policy. The purpose is to ensure a work environment free of abusive conduct. It applies to all county personnel, including interactions with contractors, vendors, clients, and the public. The commitment is to promote courtesy, respect, and professional conduct in the workplace by all county personnel. I'm going to go over what abusive conduct is under this policy. Abusive conduct includes verbal abuse, derogatory marks, insults, epithets. Is that how I say that? Okay, thanks. I shouldn't have asked then. Threatening, intimidating, or humiliating behavior, sabotaging or undermining work performance. One single act may qualify if it's especially severe and egregious, and it does not require a protected class element such as race or gender. A note on enforcement and prohibition on retaliation if you report abusive conduct. And abusive conduct includes acts by contractors, vendors, and others affiliated with the county. There's no retaliation. An employee is protected for reporting abusive conduct, participating in an investigation, or opposing abusive behavior in good faith. If you violate this policy, it may result in disciplinary action, including dismissal. Any questions about that? We're almost to the end. Just some brief comments about the Political Reform Act and conflicts of interest. These are things that you should look out for in your decisions and when various items come up. Of participating in decisions where you have a financial interest could be a conflict of interest. This includes investments, income, includes interest in income, investments, real property, or business entities. And if you are, this only applies if you are required to submit Form 700, which I don't believe that your body does, because you just give recommendations, right? Then there are some gift limitations. I will skip over that because it does not apply. So lastly, the ethics training requirement, which you were speaking to, this is codified under government code 53235. So if a local agency provides compensation, stipend, or reimburses actual and necessary expenses to its legislative body members, then all local agency officials must receive ethics training. So your commission qualifies for this. It must consist of at least 2 hours of training covering general ethics principles, ethics laws relevant to public service, like conflicts of interest and gift rules that I just stated. And then new commissioners or officials, the training must be completed within 1 year from the start of the service, of taking the oath. And then there's a reoccurring requirement at least once every 2 years thereafter. My office does not put on this ethics training. Often outside counsel is hired, and I believe that the Board of Supervisors has hosted ethics training for appointees and commissioners in the past. That's not under my purview. I do not have the answer for that, but it should be looked into. If you need an ethics training, you should reach out to staff so they can coordinate to see if there's an ethics training coming up. I believe last year there was one in October.
We're getting mileage, so we're eligible. We're required to take ethics training. Mileage payment.
Yes. Extending. Yes.
I think I'm due because I think I started on the commission maybe over 2 years ago, so I probably need to do it again.
Well, you're supposed to do it within the first year.
No, I did that.
Oh, okay. But the last time I did ethics training, it was all online. Is that still the case, or is there somebody comes in and does it?
I don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
The county does offer it online because when I first started on this commission, I did the online training, and then they give you a test at the end, and you pass the test. And
that's something you should follow up with staff, and they can coordinate with the relevant office to get you that information. But I provided that because I know that it was requested as to what the government code required.
I will ask Angelica to put that on our agenda for our next meeting regarding ethics training.
I have one more question. This PowerPoint that you gave us, is that online? So could you send it to us electronically?
I'll ask staff to do that.
Thank you.
You guys were going to add the part about the different commissions, like the different structures.
Ad hoc and...
Right.
I'm not going to add that because that's not what was available to the public. It's not identical. If you want more information about that, I can write a little paragraph and it can be read to you by staff as like a staff announcement.
Thank you. Al, do you have any more questions?
Oh, I finally ran out.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time and energy. And
there's a lot of confusion over the Brown Act. And I think you've explained it better than most other people have, and I understand it better. It's still confusing, but it's getting closer.
That's good. I'm glad it's in the right direction. You do have to take public comment on this item, so just as a reminder.
Is there anyone in the audience that would like to speak on this matter?
There are no speakers.
Raised hands, and so we thank you for your time and we'll move on. And note the time, and let's move on to item 3, new business, appointing members of the PRH commission to participate in a nominating committee for chair and vice chair. This would be a committee. An ad hoc committee. Right. Okay. Here we go. Item 3. We need to have a members participate in a nominating committee. Who would like to be on the nominating committee? Chair and vice chair.
Should be somebody who's not chair and vice chair should be on the committee.
I agree.
I mean, whoever's on the nominating committee is not eligible to serve as chair or vice chair.
The military, it would be all volunteers step forward. One member who's absent?
No. Do we make this report next month?
Correct.
And as an ad hoc committee, we can communicate with one another during the week and make comments. That's correct?
For clarification, that is correct. Since this is an ad hoc subcommittee, as long as the subcommittee group is not consists of a quorum, this should be fine.
Be one of them.
Thank you. Thank you, Al.
You need at least one more person.
Okay. Go. I'll also be on that committee.
Thank you. Is there anyone from the audience that would like to speak on this matter?
There are no speakers.
Okay. So we have a committee of two. And thank you very much for your participation in this nominating committee for chair and vice chair. We will take this up again at next month's meeting, and then we vote in January, correct?
The vote must occur in December, and then the new vice chair and chair will be in effect in the new year.
I've got one more question for you in regards to this. There's two of us. Can we ask individual other members of the commission if they're interested to serve on it? And when do we violate the Brown Act? How many can we ask?
That's a question I'd have to get confirmation from county council regarding communication.
She ran away, didn't she?
What's the math, though? I thought you had the math all written down, like 3 to 1. If there's 5 members, it's only 2, or you had the numbers.
Need 4, because we've got 6 members on the commission, so we need one more than middle. So okay, we need 4 to make a quorum. But we've got 2 on a subcommittee, and if we're contacting individual members, when do we violate the Brown Act? If I contact James and Jacqueline contacts James, and then I contact Jim and or Linda, when does it become a violation of the Brown Act?
Staff will reach out to council and then clarify with the subcommittee members.
You'll let us know in the next couple of days.
There might be a helpful suggestion if you have only one member contact certain members to limit the scope. So if you had 3 volunteers, they could only contact.
Like, you lost me.
Something like that. Yeah.
She'll check it out and communicate with Al, please. All right, let's move on to old business.
Public have anything?
Any further comments from the public? We asked once, we'll ask again.
There are no speakers.
Okay. We'll move on to old business. These are potential action items. Just rest of time, let's remember that we have a number of items in old business that we are continuing.
Chair Patterson,
yes.
For clarification for item H, the previous one regarding appointing a Parks, Recreation, and Historical Commission members, you will need to make a motion for the nominations to confirm.
Thank you very much. I do make a motion that we will appoint our 2 commissioners that have volunteered, and that would be Linda and Al.
Jackie.
Oh, I'm sorry. You did say you shook your head. I'm sorry. I make a motion for these 2 members to be the members of the committee, ad hoc committee, nominate chair and vice chair, which we will vote on in December.
Second.
Commissioner Farley?
Aye.
Commissioner Felix?
Aye.
Commissioner Menard?
Aye.
Commissioner Willis? And Chair Patterson?
Aye.
Motion passes.
Thank you for that. Now we will take up old business. Anxious. Ooh, this. Item IA, Chenard Barn, Palomares Road, Castro Valley. Linda, do you have an update?
I do not have an update. I don't know if staff has heard when this next community meeting was going to occur, but I don't have any information on whether there's another meeting with the East Bay Regional Park District on this subject.
Staff has no updates on Chenard Barn. We're not aware of a future meeting regarding this item.
Did I contact East Bay Regional Park District, or is that something that your office?
Staff can contact the point of contact. I believe it's with East Bay Regional Park District, Kim Tai, who's the project manager on this.
It was supposed to be in the fall, just a public meeting to discuss whether the barn is or go.
Staff can reach out.
Regarding item IA, is there any raised hands from the members of the public?
There are no speakers.
Move on to item B, potential historical survey project. This is from staff.
Afternoon, commissioners. Just a brief update on the potential historical survey, the Castro Valley survey. So we just wanted to confirm that the board has approved $40,000 for the historic survey of Castro Valley, and staff is preparing a scope of work that reflects that amount. Our intent is to work on the draft scope in October, and once the draft is ready, we will share that with your commission for feedback.
So the report that we just received from the historical architect, very extensive of properties that are potentially historic. Will any of those properties be considered in the survey?
We have no specific properties that are anticipated to be, we're not quite at that point yet.
Okay.
To determine which ones will be surveyed, but that will be part of the scope development process.
Sure on that. Some of the surveys I've read about, what they normally do is they go down every street that existed 50 years ago, or 45 now, I believe it is now, and identify all the houses, addresses that are in existence on those streets at 45 years of age, and consider them potential historical resources, and then go out and take a do more research. But that's their first guideline, first drop-off point. Is that correct? Is that what the architect is planning, or whoever's going to do it, or have you have any idea?
For clarification, staff has not yet drafted the scope, but we are. You know, if the commission has any comments, we're happy to hear any recommendations for staff to include in the scope. In regards to information to share with potential consultants, we're happy to include any information, for example, that has been shared regarding like a previous HRE that was completed can be included as like an appendix, I believe, in the future once the scope of work is completed, so that any future applicant could look at that for information or as a data point as part of the proposal.
Thank you.
For that update, is there anyone in the public that would like to speak to this?
No raised hands.
Move on to item IC, the Mills Act project. Again, that is a staff item.
Again, so since we last met in September, the Mills Act and Historic Preservation FAQ handouts were sent to members of the Castro Valley, Eden Area, and Fairview MACs at the commission's request. Staff has also looked into posting information in local newspapers like the Castro Valley Times, San Leandro Times, and Tri-City Voice. The cost is approximately $600 per newspaper, and there may be budget for this. But in the meantime, staff recommends preparing a press release or potentially sending out an email to those signed up to the county listserv, which has about 500 people signed up. And just as an aside, staff is working on updating the Historic Preservation website. And that will include updated information about the Mills Act and other historic preservation programs.
I posted an ad in one of the local papers here, and they had a community bulletin, which was free. And then they had another one where it was like 60 words for, they ran it for weeks and weeks and weeks for like $60 or $50. It was really cheap, and it just kept running over and over and over.
But that's a good suggestion.
Community bulletin area. You have to put it in the community bullet. That's the free section.
Okay. Thank you for that suggestion. We'll look into that.
Okay. Any input from the public?
There are no speakers.
And thank you for that. I know that this is Commissioner Farley's potential tree ordinance project. County staff, do we have any updates on that? Is there anything that we need to have our agenda?
Staff does have just a quick update. So just to remind the commission that in August, the planning department did officially accept $685,000 awarded from CAL FIRE Community and Urban Forestry Grant Program to complete a public tree inventory and canopy analysis and to develop a comprehensive urban forest plan focused in the unincorporated areas of the county. So from that, planning staff is currently preparing a request for proposal for consultant services to support the project. And so the intent is that the RFP, request for proposal, is to initiate the project, is drafted under review, and then the project planner anticipates on releasing this RFP in the next month or so. So at this time, there is a request to the commission.
In the survey, I think they should at least establish historical or heritage trees, old trees, as they're doing the survey. So we get two birds with one stone. We are getting data for our commission because they're finding the older trees and they're marking them. So we know, and then they can report back to us about, you know, what heritage trees or older trees they found, because that is our preview is protecting old things. So
staff can relay that information to the project planner.
Any item from the public?
There are no raised hands.
On to the Midland Act.
Staff has no update at this time.
Item IF, stipends for members of this commission. Ms.
For the previous item, there are no speakers for the record.
So waiting to hear offer from the council.
This time, there are no updates. We are still waiting to hear back from the county's administrator's office on this item.
And is this attractive at all for this year, if it's approved or not? Do you know?
That would be a question that I need to ask our finance team.
Do we have any from members? Our audience or public?
There are no raised hands.
Item IG, question of the RHC letters to the Board of Supervisors and to the Castro Valley MAC to support funding to preserve the old Castro Valley Library, Lake Chabot Nike Missile Base site, and White Cotton Cottage and San Lorenzo Pioneer Cemetery. Those letters were approved and mailed. I said earlier, I'm still waiting to hear from comment.
So I would just comment that since the Mr. DeVinny is in the Castro Valley MAC,
correct,
then I can.
On item G, correct?
Yes.
Okay. I did a little research on veterans halls, and that the Castro Valley Libraries can be considered for veterans hall. I looked at the 900 forms to see how much money they take in, and Hayward took in $463,000 in 1 year. They have different programs, rentals, different programs. So they make money off the programs that they They have this yoga program in Alameda. Alameda made $464,000 in 1 year. So the potential's there for the Castro Valley Library to make just as much by maybe going to these other veteran organizations that are already established and getting that information and help them have some great programs. And really, the Board of Supervisors should look at this. I have the information. I got to type it out. I got injured and I'm in the process of buying a house, but I have the information. I'm going to type it out and I'll send it. It's called the 900 form. And if you want to see how much the veteran halls made in different cities, you look up the 900 form and then that gives you that data information.
The chair, I sent a letter on the Castro Valley Library to Commissioner Board of Supervisor Hobart about this issue and got a comment back from Kathy Kimberlin, who's a Fremont aide, and she said that the supervisor was very supportive of Veterans Affairs and that she would forward it on, and she suggested I contact Miley, and I haven't decided yet whether that's a violation of the Brown Act or not, so I'm waiting. Probably will not.
Still on G, I have one more comment. I did a little more research, and they talked about the Pioneer Cemetery with the floating bodies and the whatever you call that,
headstones.
Headstones. There is a process to go get money from Caltrans, and they have a program. You can get up to $12,500 if you put a somebody help me with the wording here. Put a claim in. You put a claim in.
Apply for a grant.
No, it's not a grant. It's a claim. You put a claim in with Caltrans, and they pay up to $12,500. If the damage is more considerate, they go into litigation. So everybody that's gone into litigation with Caltrans has gotten in the millions because there was a water issue somewhere else, and the people ended up getting like millions of dollars because it exceeded the claim of 12.5. So 12,500 is the minimum Caltrans will give for a
claim.
So everybody that exceeded that went into litigation with Caltrans and sued them, and they all won. Every single case was won by the litigants.
The question that that's really great information. Do you have to be a private party to litigate a claim, or can?
Well, they had municipalities doing it.
So county
could sue. They had a lot of different people went after Caltrans, and in every single case, Caltrans lost.
So, I do have in my files the report from the Hayward Historical Society pointing out what all the intrusions. Information about this to bring to the next meeting.
Oh, I will share the litigation with the county. They especially the one with the related to water, because that kind of has it's related to water also. And Caltrans lost, and it was over $14 million. So I'll share that.
So yeah, so if we could put that on the agenda to discuss the water intrusion in this report that Hayward Historical Society has, with whatever form there is to do it, and see buddy or not.
If it's going to cost more, if they do a survey and it costs more than 12.5, then they shouldn't go fill out, because they're just going to get the minimum. They should go for the litigation.
Again, I'd like to reinforce that we have sent letters to the Castro Valley MAC and to the Board of Supervisors regarding our interest in funding these facilities. Castro Valley Library, White Cotton Cottage, Nike Missile Site, Pioneer Cemetery. I'd like to thank Commissioner Farley for investigating, and we'll take that up at our next meeting.
There's one more. Since we're on G, I did reach out to Eric Swalwell's office, and they sent me a link on how to get everything on the National Registry and even how to make a national park. So I have those links, and I can send those to the county. That's already written up, so I'll transpose it or send it. Yeah.
And I've also been looking at that as well. So I think as a commission, we could we could try to get some of the properties that might be relevant on the National Register. There's also money from the national parks to, for instance, repair things in cemeteries. I think at this point, with what's going on with the shutdown, probably national parks are not ready to receive any information, but I think we can still
research.
Yeah. And also in regards to the letters, I would like to know from the staff what the date is for the Board of Supervisors meeting on this issue, and also the Castro Valley MAC.
It's a great question. Staff does have one update. Our CDA, Community Development Agency, Economic Civic Development Director, Eileen Dalton, will be making a presentation at the planning board meeting scheduled on October 9th, specifically about the old Castro Valley Library. So this meeting usually occurs at 10 a.m. and it's located at 1221 Oak Street in Oakland. It's also hybrid, so you're able to attend in person if you choose to. And once the agenda materials are available, I will forward that information to the commission.
So that's just...
It's on the Castro Valley Library, you said, yeah.
It's only for the Castro Valley Library, for a planning board presentation on October 9th at 10 a.m.
About the Castro Valley MAC, I think they were still going to vote on this issue.
I does not have any additional updates related to future presentations aside from this presentation focused on old Castro Valley Library.
Okay, and is there anything on the supervisor was going to meet, I believe, in October to decide whether or not to fund rotation of these properties? Do we have a meeting date for that?
This time, staff has no updates related to that as well.
Can you send that to
us? As I receive additional information, I'm happy to send an email to the commission for updates.
Great. And if you can send it as soon as you get it so we can attend, I would appreciate it. Thank you.
Actually incorporated item H as well, because that was a discussion of the missile base, White Cotton Cottage, San Lorenzo Pioneer Cemetery. Anyone in the public regarding item G here, discussion of the...
No raised hands.
Well, there's still a bit of discussion left on item H regarding Pioneer Cemetery. Place. Is there discussion?
I would like to make sure that James and I are listed as an ad hoc committee to discuss and share information about this topic. We'll be short term as soon as we get the information.
We have it. So,
and I have some
anytime.
Okay.
And then you talk. I'm not. IH, any other, is there any input from the public regarding this matter?
There are no speakers.
And we go to item II, which Vice Chair expressed concerns at our previous meeting.
Yes, this bridge was dedicated by the Board of Supervisors. It's from the 1930 era. It's a historical landmark because it was dedicated by the Board of Supervisors. It's got the traditional bridge pylons like the old Lincoln Highway used to have, the same style, and it's worth preserving. So if you can find somebody that can save it and make it its original way, that'd be nice.
Is it going to be demolished? Is that the issue? Or
I don't know. The staff probably knows more than I do about it.
So we do have a brief update. So just as a reminder for context, in August, staff reported that the board took action on June 17th to approve a list of projects to be funded with road maintenance and rehabilitation funds, including the Center Street Bridge replacement. So staff reached out to Public Works and was informed that preliminary design, including the project scope, hasn't started yet, but is anticipated to begin later this year, tentatively in December.
I would, instead of revamping it, if they could consider the traditional style, maybe it may be comparable in price. They have to look at it first. I would like to know what the difference is between demolishing it and building a new one, or sticking with the traditional, because we have a good fight on our hands if we can prove that the bridge costs just as much or the same if we keep it traditional.
I have a comment. I know that on Highway 101, north of Humboldt, there is the last remaining wooden bridge that connects communities along Highway 101, and that the state has seen fit to demolish that bridge because it is wood and reconfigure it. I don't know what materials they would use. The state is claiming that it is cheaper to build a new bridge than to restore the old bridge. In any event, I think the commission has an appropriate concern regarding what is going to be done to the Center Street Bridge, and we would like to be informed of that. And relative to Commissioner Farley's question, I do think it's a good question to be asked and to be answered here at the commission regarding the cost and of any potential modification to that old bridge. So
let me bring up one more comment. They must have molds, because back in the day they used molds to form these. There could be in some warehouse somewhere, because they still have the bridge. If you go down Dublin Canyon Road, they still have the traditional bridges down there. So they may have the mold somewhere. They pour the concrete in and they mold it, and then they put it up. Because if they have the molds, that'll save them a lot of money, and that actually may save a lot of money.
So I have a comment also. Is the transportation department required to do a demolition permit, since this has been dedicated by the Board of Supervisors as being historic? It's also over 50 years old. Are they required to get a demolition permit as well?
They need to get clarification from Public Works on that.
Yeah, that would be really helpful, because I mean, according to protocol, everyone else has had to do that. So I would assume they would come to us to review it, like we have with all the other historic properties that come before this commission.
the bottom line is this commission is very interested in what Department of Transportation has in store or in mind regarding the Center Street Bridge, and we would like to be up to.
If I may, staff, as a suggestion, would like to recommend possibly drafting a letter to Public Works with your recommendations, and maybe we can relay that information to Public Works so they're aware of them. That, you know, in similar to the letter that was prepared for Old Castro Valley and White Cotton Cottage, possibly a ad hoc subcommittee could be developed that would prepare that draft letter, which could then be followed up for further review at the next meeting and then can be distributed to the Public Works Department if the commission so chooses.
Well, the reason why I want to bring this up is because all the bridges that are the traditional white bridges are all in unincorporated. Because if you go down Dublin Canyon Road, that's all Castro Valley. And when once you get to Pleasanton, the bridge is not there.
So we will all the, we'll put Commissioner bridges. Farley in charge of the that ad hoc committee.
All right. So I got one more job to do. All right.
So I take it no demo permit has been filed at this point that you know of?
Staff will need to do some research related to what process occurs when a bridge, for example, is demolished. It's not clear at this time. We're familiar with structures such as building, but not to this extent, such as a bridge. So we'll need to do some further research.
So I might suggest if the be that we wait to get your information on whether it makes sense to go ahead with a letter. Maybe bridges aren't included in historic preservation.
And the two bridges that are in the unincorporated area are on the Lincoln Highway too, by the way. Those are two Lincoln Highway bridges, and they're not going to let them get destroyed.
At this point, what I would like to make known is the commission is extremely interested in what's going to happen with Center Street Bridge. We would like any updates that you can provide us. And if that includes speaking with someone from the Department of Transportation, that'll be appreciated.
I'll take pictures of the three bridges in the unincorporated Alameda County and send them out to the county so they have, you know, them, but public record.
Also believe that the city of San Leandro has a bridge on East 14th that was built by Alameda County Board and approved by the Board of Supervisors because there's a lovely back on all the Board of Supervisors.
It's a white bridge again.
It's another white bridge, and it's a chokehold, but it works to slow down traffic in San Leandro. Okay, so we will consider that. Item IJ, Sanol Bridge, Mr. Menard.
Did you ask for?
Oh, public comment on Center Street Bridge. Do we have any comments?
There are no raised hands.
There are no raised hands. Okay, we'll move on to Mr. Menard.
Okay, I got information. I wrote a letter to Caltrans, and I got this response on September 1st, 2025. The California Department of Transportation received a request for records under the Public Records Act, wherein you requested the following. Highway 84 bridge replacement in Niles Canyon about 2021. The historical memorials on each of the bridge on each end of the bridge that was removed were hopefully preserved, and the Washington Township Museum of Local History, 190 Anza Street, Fremont, California, would like one of them for their museum. Also, we understand that Caltrans has a museum, and I would like to have the opportunity to visit this museum. They said, Caltrans is in the process of gathering and reviewing the requested records. Your request will take extra time to fill because of the need to the need to research, to search for and collect the requested records from field facilities or other establishments that are consequently Caltrans is exercising its authority under government code section such and such 7922.535 to extend the time to reply to a Public Records Act request. You will receive a further more complete response no later than October 16th, 2025. Thank you for your patience in awaiting this information. Now, do I have to send this to give this to staff so that you can be included with the minutes? Probably a good idea, huh?
Yes, if you could provide a copy to staff.
They shall do that.
That would be great. Thank you.
Any comments from the public regarding this matter of Sunol Bridge?
There are no speakers.
We do have, we'll move on to item J, commission announcements. And I'll start at the beginning over at, to my left. Do we have any comments?
We have been. Oh, I'm conflicted as to stay on.
The commission's looking at staff for a response. Staff will need to get confirmation from county council in order to confirm if there is a conflict of interest. So at this time, I don't have a response to this.
Me, that the Hayward Library is an incorporated Hayward city limits, and so this commission deals specifically with unincorporated Alameda County, which would not conflict, in my opinion. And I know that in Fremont, the Kathy Kimberlin is a representative for Halbert as the Board of Supervisors and was just recently elected to City Council and checked, and that was completely approved. And those are closer to conflict than what you have over here, I think.
As the chair, I appreciate your opinion, and I still want some legal support for that opinion. Al, do you have any comments or announcements?
A couple of announcements. The Shin House, the historic Shin House in Fremont, next year we'll celebrate 150 years of existence. And we plan on doing many celebrations for that event. And one of the first is an organization that you may or may not have heard of. It's called the Bay Area Historic House Museums. It represents 30 some odd historic houses throughout the greater Bay Area. And they have quarterly meetings on the second Monday of every quarter, and January is the next one, and it will be held at Shin House. And I am inviting any one of you who wants to show us a Monday at approximately 10 o'clock in the morning. Starts at 9:30 or something, and 10 o'clock coffee and donuts and all that kind of stuff, and then a sandwich or something later, or something like $15 to $20.
Have something really support. A very historical and icon barn was torn down. The flag barn between unincorporated Alameda County and unincorporated Contra Costa County has been dismantled. They were afraid somebody would get hurt. Everybody looked at the barn as they drove past it. Everybody knows the barn. If you've ever driven Vasco Road, the little flag barn, it's totally been dismantled. So we lost another historical thing. Nobody made comments about it. It was just taken down. on Vasco Road. It's between Livermore and in Contra Costa and unincorporated area.
Hearing him.
I have heard rumors that the Silver Fern barn on the access road near the Hard Rodeo may also be demolished.
Not doing a good job.
There. On that sad note, however, I do want to note that I did download the Tesla Road, Alameda County material about state parks. We did get the commission was presented by the state about that project over by the RV and motorized area. So it seems to be moving, but they're still in a information gathering stage. I also received an email from one of our commissioners, but it was really addressed to the commission from Maria McGowan regarding the Sky West golf course, which has been closed for some time. Alameda County was using the club as a COVID area during COVID. There's some discussion going on about what's going to happen, and so I'd like to know from staff if we can get an update from the Board of Supervisors on that. Or at least, at the very least, put that on the agenda for our next meeting.
Does Hard have jurisdiction over Sky West?
I believe so, yes.
Pardon me. Thank you. With us and my...
Scott, has Hard had any community meetings about this subject? And are they in favor of... Okay.
I'd like to put that Sky West golf course on our agenda for comments or reports.
I don't think.
It says liaison reports.
I think you covered it, Chair Patterson. I just wanted to make sure that the commission is aware of the online survey that's available by State Parks Department. This is, as Chair Patterson mentioned, information gathering stage. So there is a request to provide any input on the draft declaration of purpose, vision statement, and draft concepts on the Tesla plan. So feel free to incorporate your responses in that online survey. And I believe it closes on Halloween. So just want to let you know. And I have been in contact with Mrs. Maria the last name is escaping me here, but there's been a request by the Save Open Space and Sky West committee, and so one of the committee members will be making a presentation at the next meeting.
Thank you.
Actually, I would like to know, could we add historic barns onto the agenda as well?
Yes, staff can certainly add historic barns to the agenda. So for clarification, is this just a discussion of historic barns to be included to the agenda?
Yes, I would like to just present some information about how many historic barns there are in at least starting with the Castro Valley, see how many historic barns there are and to see if the owners of those barns will be getting the letters regarding the Mills Act, just to provide some information.
Staff can include that into the agenda and can work with you, Commissioner Willis, on the information that you'd like to include in the agenda.
Okay, great. And when does that need to be, if there's any written information, when do you need it?
About 2 weeks in advance of the meeting.
Next meeting is November 6th, but before we adjourn, are there any comments or statements from the public? Any raised hands?
There are no raised hands.
And from the commissioner here. I'm Al Menard. On Monday, I turned the ripe old age of 86 years of age. And in the back, there's a bundt cake that I hope all of you will eat completely because I'm not taking it home. Okay. And I congratulate all of you for putting up with me all these years because I've enjoyed my time on this board and I'm going to continue until I find somebody that's as good as I am.
Well, happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
And thank you for all your, you know, it's been a long time since you've been on and off this commission, and you are our most respected historian on the commission.
Too carried away. Most respected.
Meeting adjourned.
Thank you.
New house I bought. I'm in